Longhorn Nation, we're back.
Hello, Longhorn Nation. Welcome to the, welcome back to the, welcome with the, who the, what? That song confused me. The triumphant, triumphal, triumphish return of the Barking Carnival Unplugged podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jason Chilton, a.k.a. Nobis 60. With me, as always, Jacob Dedamore, a.k.a. Kip's Big Boy. How are you, Mr. Dedamore?
I'm working through the technical issues, so okay. I'm doing okay right now.
All right, so back where we left it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the irascible and irredeemable Willie Waylon McClyde, a.k.a. Craig Douglas, or vice versa.
Well, I tell you what, boys, I just got back from our family's annual beach trip at Seaside, Florida, and I'm glad to be back here because I saw most of the SEC's incoming sorority pledge classes down there, and I found myself thinking things that had gotten me the needle at Rayford.
And we're off. Okay.
Gosh, nothing like a relaxing weekend in jailbait K.
Oh, good God. Yes,
and
this is how we're starting.
We at the BC Unplugged podcast are pleased to welcome a fourth member to the regular rotation. He's been a frequent guest and at times has outshone the nominal title hosts of this podcast, but we are thrilled to welcome to the permanent rotation none other than good friend of the show, Mr. Sean Connery.
Sean, we welcome you as a regular member of this podcast. Thank you for joining us and taking time out of your schedule.
Yes, well, it is busy, but I am honored to be a part of your podcast. And to commemorate my addition to the permanent rotation, I've decided to focus more thoroughly on the analysis components. I managed to, while using the Gensch Laboratory here at Mount Thunder, managed to get myself a copy of Dave Campbell's Texas Football.
Oh, always a good start, yes.
Well, yes, you always want to go with the one with the Scottish surname. We have a choice. So I perused that in there, and by the way, if you'd ever wondered how Mount Thunder got its name, 5 minutes in there will tell you. There are a few forces on this earth powerful enough to crack porcelain, but apparently Mr. McClyde has mastered one of them. But at any rate, I spent a solid 10-15 minutes with that publication, and I feel ready to opine on the Longhorn's fortunes.
Well, feel free. Give us your opinions.
Yes, well, so I'll dive right in. Apparently this returning quarterback James Brown seems to be quite the rage, and if he and this Mike Adams, is it, are able to make a connection, then the offense should be...
Well, you know, Mr. Connery, those were names that would have been apropos in Longhorn analysis in about 1996.
What show they want? The players change every year or something. They cycle them out.
Yes. Unfortunately, they tend to graduate, allegedly, and move on to the next level of their lives, and then new players come in.
I was not aware of that.
Although they don't graduate as much as they just kind of matriculate. So.
I think that's probably a better word for it.
Yes, thank you for interjecting yet another SAT word, Mr. McClyde. But I suppose that it's all become clear to me. My entire picture of the Texas football program was formed in 1969 when I was stopping by. Got to meet Del Royal and bang. Who was it? Maybe Sharon Tate on the 50-yard line. Persuaded someone to let us in, but I always assumed the team was a power. But if the players change, you must be laboring through your Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton years as a program. So, and it makes more sense to me. But I'll step back from the microphone now, perhaps do a bit more research and attempt to contribute later.
Oh, well, thank you for that, Mr. Connery. We will definitely bring you back after you've brushed up a bit on modern University of Texas football. By the way, the Dave Campbell's magazine is about the sport of football throughout the state of Texas, not just Texas Longhorn football.
Oh, by the way, Sean, if that magazine's actually just a cover, there's some better stuff underneath there.
Oh yes, I did find one of those as well. Normally, the only peeing that goes on in the restroom is actually in the toilet. With the right issue of Hustler, you can make that change.
Oh God.
I assume we have a dump button. I assume some of these things won't get us in hot water with the SEC, the FCC, or the SEC.
Well, the SEC, you know, they really don't give a rat's ass about much of anything that, you know.
Oh, unless Mr. McLeod is balls deep in one of their underage daughters.
Yes. All right, we will hear more from Mr. Connery later. We do appreciate his contributions as always, so... But, you know, welcome back, everybody. We know it's been a hot minute since we were on the microphones here and on the podcast. And I guess a good place to start is, guys, I mean, kind of what have your thoughts been, just kind of where the overall program is? As we are, you know, as we're recording this, they are in day three of practice for fall camp right now. But just kind of coming off of last season, you know, what are your thoughts on things?
Do you mean what my thoughts were? Like a day ago, or like once I started my feverish cribbing for this podcast, tried to remember more than the names of eight members of the team.
Yeah. Let's go after. How about that?
Okay, after. Sounds good. For me, which helped me in my sense of who, what, and where, like where we are, doesn't hurt to take a quick 90-second spin through last season, which I kind of characterized as Maryland. What the fucking fuck? What is again?
Yeah.
Oh, God, help us.
Again?
Yeah. Tulsa, wow. 28-21, looking good, Tom. Then we have our surprise victory over what we knew was not going to be a good USC team, but still 37-14 over a national name. Mm-hmm. National has been a power. Okay, great. Nice little run culminated by beating OU. Like, holy shit, is this really happening? The great euphoria that catches up any fan base. Like, it was at Shock the Nation 2-time.
Yeah.
Come on, baby, let's do this thing. Then the three-game stretch of, hey, Todd Orlando, what the fucking fuck is happening with the 38-35 loss to OSU, then get outshot by West Virginia, then barely sneak by Tech. Then you've got your late season, you know, kind of playing down to around, but still getting by ISU squeaker against Kansas. Like,
Yeah, the squeaker against Kansas was very disappointing, at least from what you expected. The Iowa State game, actually, I thought, especially considering the fact, and we'll get into this more later when we get into the team, how they were playing with their backup quarterback in that game, you know, I thought went pretty well, because Iowa State, we're going to talk about them later too, I'm sure, a little bit, but you know, they were surprisingly good last year, and you know, they expect to be a pretty solid team in the Big 12 again this year. But yeah, I mean, you're right, there was that stretch after where you're like, okay, we're winning games. Yeah, the OSU game sucked because the defense played like crap, but
yeah,
they were still winning games and progressing, and they still ended up getting in the Big 12 title game.
Yeah, and then you know, the first ever season rematch with OU, hung in for three quarters strong, failed late again. Todd Orlando, what the fuck's going on? Even though that was, you know, one of the more potent offenses in college football history.
Right.
Then going in, oh, well, congratulations. We've allowed the SEC to set us up for the Anton Chigurh cattle gunning against Georgia. And then go out there and, you know, front to back, man to man, in the trenches and everywhere else, solidly beat a Georgia team, whatever post facto bullshit about didn't want to be there that the SEC honk started to crank out.
It
so
just matters more until we decide it doesn't.
until exactly. We decide we don't care.
Exactly, yeah. So where we are now is coming off a 10-win season and trying to decide what does success mean for Texas now. We'll talk about that, but that's where I'm at is – what does it mean for Texas to come off of its first 10-win season in quite some time, and where can this team take the next step?
Craig?
The thing that made last year kind of tough to gauge was the fact that we didn't beat the shit out of anybody.
No.
I mean, they won. It was just kind of classic Al Davis just win, baby kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was like a race with two guys connected by a big old rubber band. Like
yeah.
You could not literally get ahead, but some force would fucking propel them back next to you.
Yeah, yeah. They tended to play down to their competition.
And up to it.
And up to it, yeah, in several respects. But I think Sam obviously had a great year. He propelled himself into a Heisman candidacy for 2019. But I think until Texas blows some people out, the jury's going to be out, at least nationally.
Yeah, that's kind of my thought. I mean, there are some legitimate expectations of this team coming into this year, in my opinion, even more so than last season. There were some expectations coming into last season, but I think they're even higher this year because of how they ended the season. You know, that win over Georgia, I mean, Texas was an underdog by what? Over a touchdown, I think.
10 points, I believe.
10 points, yeah.
Yeah, that line bounced around, but yeah, it was definitely at 10.
Yeah, it was. They were. Close to going yeah, so I mean, depending on what line you're looking at, you're talking about a double digit underdog against a Georgia team, and you know that.
I didn't know there was one poor son of a bitch who took my money at 10.
Good on you, sir. But I mean, but there are, because of how last season ended. Yes, they played. That was probably the only. There were two really consistent things about the Longhorn football team last year. One, Sam Ellinger was not going to turn the ball over, and two, the team as a whole was going to play either up or down to their competition, regardless of what level it was. And that happened all season long, and that's why we had close games against teams like Kansas and Tulsa, you know, and losses to Maryland. But then they go beat Oklahoma, where they basically kicked Oklahoma's ass for three quarters, let them back in the game, and then eventually won. You know, we hung with what, I mean, the West Virginia game, I mean, yeah, that game sucked to lose, but I mean, it was back and forth the whole day. But, you know, again, that was a team that Texas, you know, was West Virginia, a very good West Virginia team. And then same thing, OU the second time. You know, three quarters, it's back and forth, had a failure late, and then just to go and dominate Georgia for the vast majority of that football game. I know they scored late to make it look close, but, I mean, Texas controlled that game from start to finish and really out-physicaled a team that no one thought they could out-physical. And so now they've got legitimate expectations coming into this year, and I'm honestly curious to see how they handle it because, I mean, despite all the expectations, there are some parts of this football team that you look at and you're just kind of like, I'm not sure about this.
Yeah, I think that's right. And part of our mission statement of the revamped, relaunched, and something with Re that's not coming right now version
retooled?
Of the BC. Yeah, that works. We've got
three tools.
Got three
here,
tools,
so, why not?
So that works. But yeah, less
for yourself.
less overall over analysis and stat wonkery, but. You know, as Mr. McLeod said, you know, the tight game, close game, every game thing. You know, a lot of your more advanced stats will say, you know, hey, two great teams play each other, it can be a coin flip. Like
right.
The big mark of a really quality team, you know, at the college or NFL level, you are consistently beating the shit out of the lesser opponents. You're winning by three or four touchdowns. You were leaving no doubt, and you know that was not a hallmark of this team, despite you know the shiny final moment, shiny final record, and you've got a whole lot of turnover on the defensive side of the ball.
No, Jason, they just shouldn't have enough explosives.
Well, they should have visited the washroom at Mount Thunder.
As Connery pipes back in with a little quick one-liner to jump back out. But thanks, Mac. Aren't you busy over in North Carolina right now?
Well, you know, I thought I'd just pop back in and say hello.
Mac is actually correct, though. That was also a hallmark of the Texas offense was a lack of explosives last year. I was really shocked to read that stat, by the way, that Texas did not have an offensive play of over 38 yards all season.
Well, it was over 48 yards. Their longest carry was 39 yards.
Okay, yeah. Longest carry. Okay, not a play over 48 yards. Okay. Mm-hmm. Still, just a surprising stat. It didn't occur to me that had happened last year.
Well, they were nothing if not methodical.
Well, that's true.
You know, I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. And Herman, you know, one of the hallmarks of his offense is, you know, heavy run, ball control, but still, you know, there have been a lot of heavy run ball control offenses, but top five, top ten teams in college football that can still roll out there and lay half a hundred on you.
Very true. And yeah.
They didn't do that.
No, they didn't at all. And so that's one of the things you look at this year. I mean, with this team, I think the expectations overall obviously are greater than they have been in either the first 2 years under Herman. But the offense is the one that's carrying the most of these expectations because of Ellinger.
Oh, sure.
You know, and because they've got a lot, they've got a lot more returning, returning talent on that side of the ball, as far as you know, playmakers.
Well, they've certainly got more returning snaps and more returning starts than they do on defense. I just, you know, we'll get into the offense here in a minute. There's a lot of things I think we can look for, and I think they hold a lot of promise. I mean, I know we sit here for the last 4 or 5 minutes and talk about, you know, hell, we're not blowing enough people out, but you know, they're winning games, and this is one way to win games. And I'm about to lapse into some really shitty coach speak, so somebody else please fucking stop.
You play to win the game. Okay, there we go. And that is true, Herm. Thank you. Sam's got all the expectations on him. You're going to have a lot. You lost a lot of productivity at wide receiver with little Jordan Humphrey going to the NFL, but Colin Johnson is back this year. You are returning.
Did little Jordan Humphrey, did he make a, is he in anybody's training camp? Or is he littler Jordan Humphrey right now?
I've got to believe he's.
I think he's in a camp somewhere.
Yeah, he's got to be in a camp. I mean, yeah, they've just started camp. So you know, whether he makes a, you know, whether he makes a roster
anyway,
or even makes
just,
a practice squad.
I digress. I think he should have stayed for his senior year, obviously. But I missed that production in the slot. But
Yep.
Absolutely. But he in a lot of ways was kind of a hallmark of the Texas offense of this consistent production. You know, he bailed us out on a ton of third downs, same third downs that fucked the Texas defense. But it was also, you know, the same attributes that made him great for us but had him not really light up the NFL radars. Yeah, he would get 20, 30 yards downfield, jump up and pull away a 50-50 ball, and there's a nice 30-yard game, but he was not catching those 75-yard bombs, running away from people, not catching a ball in space, making people miss and going. You know, he was a unique athlete, but not a burner, not a wiggle guy. And, you know, that inability to turn a 5-yard play into 50 or to really truly just take the top off and get past everybody was completely missing from the offense last year, aside from the 8 times we missed a wide-open Devin Duvernay. But that's probably the single easiest place.
Holy shit, he's all by himself!
That's the single easiest place for the Longhorns to take the next big step on offense is, Jesus Christ, we're quoting Mac Brown, getting more of those explosive plays.
Yeah, I mean, just connecting more on those plays. I mean, you mentioned it. There were so many opportunities for that last year that they just didn't connect on. But one of the things I do think, even though they've gonna have a lot of inexperienced talent, I think the wide receiver position overall is loaded with talent. And that's one of the things I'm hoping to see shine through this year is the amount and array of talent in that grouping. And I also think, you know, at the running back position, I think the overall running back position this year is going to be more explosive and is going to be a much bigger threat. I will love Trey Watson until the day I die for what he brought to this team last year. You know, he brought, especially when Ingram started to get dinged up and was missing games and was, you know, definitely, you know, being, they were trying to limit how much he carried the ball last year because of those, you know, little injuries here and there. Trey Watson was just consistent all season long, but he didn't provide any home run ability as the, you know, even though he was an experienced guy, you know, coming off the injury he came off of, he just wasn't, you know, an explosive guy. I think you're going to see a lot more explosion this year, one, because at least to start the year, Ingram's healthy, and then you've got Jordan Whittington.
To me, Whittington's the key to the whole thing. You know, and it's a lot of pressure to put on a true freshman, but, you know, there are so many things they can do with him that they almost have to do because tight end is not a strength for that team. So, I think you're going to see a lot of 20 personnel, some 21 personnel. And he can do so many things out of the with the passing game, motioning out, or even coming out of the backfield. Wheel routes give me a hard-on.
an unpharmaceutically enhanced hard-on at that.
Yeah. I don't have many of those, baby. I'm going on 50. I'm pounding that shit at 60 milligrams at a time.
Speedballing Viagra in Cialis. That's right. Yeah. You hit that, yeah. Certain point in life.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Don't have time for the weekend. You got to go for the short term.
Which brings us back to Jordan Whittington. despite our literal zero effective show prep, that was basically my same conclusion on offense that you had, that Jordan Whittington is the most interesting piece of the offense. Not even necessarily addition. Obviously, Ellinger's the most important player by a good margin.
He's the biggest X factor, because he's an unknown quantity.
Yeah, both in all the different schematic things that you can do, but also in that probably missing ability to, if he gets a crack of daylight, can make some highlight reel shake and miss and go the distance and can do it just as easily in the pass game as the run game and can give you some easy, cheap opportunities to not just have that workmanlike grind it out event that happened most of the times one of our running backs touched the ball last year, but something special and also a way to, you know, turn some position and formation mismatches against the defense. Since, as you mentioned, tight end is still a massive question mark, as it's been since Michael Finley.
David Thomas.
It's been a hot minute, sure.
You know, and
did you ever think the phrase, "I'm going to miss Andrew Beck," would escape your lips? I didn't think it would escape mine, but here we are.
I still don't think it's escaped mine. I can say we're thin at tight end without saying that.
Yeah, typically the only thing that escapes my lips thinking my Andrew Beck is vomit. But
okay.
But anyway.
I guess this is the point at which Andrew Beck's mom turns off the sorry about that. Anyway, from the running back standpoint, the thing that they have to do, no matter how they do it, whether they're – whatever mix they use, they have to take the pressure off Sam in the running game. Because they are just balsa wood thin at quarterback behind him. They cannot afford for him to get hurt. He carried the ball 164 times last year. I'd like to see him carry the ball probably 25, maybe even 50 fewer carries than that, which means they're going to need more production from somewhere else. They're going to have to concentrate his carries in big games and let Ingram and Whittington or whoever else, we got a gas camp candidate in there, to carry more of that load in games against lesser opponents so Sam just doesn't get beat to death.
Yeah, I mean, they've got to – now, I mean, part of that's going to be really hard to do because it's basically telling Sam, you know, not to play how he plays.
He doesn't even know how to slide, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, I mean, that's just part of it with him. But yeah, I definitely would, if I'm Texas, not have plays where he's even an option to carry the ball unless it's necessary. You know, for whatever reason, like you said, in a big game, maybe in a goal line situation because that play, you know, and Sam's ability to do that is so good. But, yeah, really try and cut back on that and see if these other guys can pick up the load.
Yeah, I mean, that's much easier said than done.
Agreed,
you know, in the overall Herman philosophy of bully ball, you know, hopefully we can break out of the overall Tom Herman philosophy of you must have a tight end on the field even if all of them are wretched, at least at times. But, you know, so much of modern offense in college is built around – you know, some of the threat of the quarterback run game, you know, the RPO game, and just the fact that, all right, you've got, after the snap, some kind of mesh in the backfield, and the defense is having to wait and react and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And you've got essentially the rebirth of the triple option game of, I could hand this ball off, I could throw it to that spot with this slant if that linebacker does this thing, or if both that's covered and I see the hole, I pull it down and run. There's three ways you can beat the defense, but that running, the quarterback keeping the ball for this kind of offense, a lot of times has to be one of them. You can tell them, be real sure on that read, you know, default to that when you have to, you know, calling typical zone read stuff, especially against lesser opponents, dial it down. If it's, you know, it's third and two at the opponent's 10, you're going to see that damn Ellinger sweep, and there's nothing to do about it.
You
and
are.
It's true. A good thing because it's fucking hard to stop.
And I know.
You're playing with fire a bit, and it's just that's a risk that they're going to have to take. But, yeah, I think you mitigate it where you can. It's just going to be hard to mitigate
it all
that much.
I say I'd like to see him have a lot fewer carries, but at the same time, you don't want to take away what's obviously a – huge strength for the offense. I mean, I'd like to have all the money I lost in the divorce back too, but shit. I mean, you can't have everything, you know. So we just take the good with the bad and, you know, hope we can keep them healthy.
Now, the good part about wanting more production out of the running backs and especially more, you know, big plays is the fact that, you know, as we saw in year one of Mr. Hand as our offensive line coach, he turned an offensive line that was 2 years ago wretched because of injuries and other things into...
Every time you say Mr. Hand...
I know. I mean, that was...
Are you thinking about Mr. Bill or are you thinking about Jacobs last Saturday night?
Or Fast Times, I don't know.
I don't know. I'm just a sick bastard.
Granted. We understand. It's okay.
Go ahead.
But Herb...
Don't just call him Herb.
Herb.
For Christ's sake. Just call him Herb.
Please, God.
God damn it.
Herb turned the offensive line last year into a very solid above-average unit, despite, you know, some obvious holes you had.
Nice unit, Mr. Hand.
Yes. This is what you love and hate about our podcast. You all know it, so just accept it.
20% of the audience has bailed already at this point. We assume that we've got our like-minded fellow travelers along at this stage.
We also have many listeners who listen just for this.
That's true, too.
You know, this unit was surprisingly good last year as a group. And yes. Oh, yes. It's awesome. It's so fun.
I mean, this unit was really actually pretty good at limiting penetration.
Yes, it was.
Oh, no.
You know.
Oh, no.
It turned into a very solid five-man group last year. And even though they've lost a lot of experience on the left side of the line, Sam Cosmi, who played fantastic at right tackle last year for the most part, he moves to the left side. Shackelford was very good all year at center. He's back, going to be your leader on that offensive line. The question is how are you going to fill in the other spots? Kerstetter, we believe, is going to be one of them, probably at right guard.
If nothing else, he's your ideal swing man.
Yeah, if nothing else, he can play any position on the line you need him to because he's that versatile. The question is how will the new Georgia Tech transfer, Parker Braun, how is he going to integrate? I know they are hopeful that he's going to be a starter he's going to have an adjustment period because of the offense he came from at Georgia Tech.
Yeah, he's got to do something besides cut block.
Right. So exactly. But he's experienced enough that you hope that he'll be able to handle all that. And if he gets integrated, then you've got an experienced group. I think maybe the biggest question is probably going to be right tackle and who mans that position.
Yeah, as it's seemed to be for a while, and here we sit, I think, 3 days into fall camp for the Longhorns as we record this, and nothing is set in stone, written in pen, or even traced with an underage girl's big toe in the sand there at Jailbait K. But it seems like who's at least penciled in there is Denzel Okafor, who, you know, to my mind, you know, so much of the good stuff about his game happens at guard rather than tackle, but just some basic technique elements would help him to avoid some of the fiascos that we saw, say, against USC the previous year and other times where he was just an absolute turnstile. I mean, he's got, you know, the frame and the athleticism to possibly do it out there. I think the ceiling of this line goes up if somebody almost like Christian Jones or maybe even Tri Kerstedt are out there. I think Braun's probably too undersized, but if somebody could do a creditable job there and you kick Okafor inside to guard, you may have your highest ceiling, but somebody else might just have a dreadful floor out there at right tackle that he ends up being just your best option to survive with.
Well, like Craig said, because of Kerstetter's versatility, I mean, I think that is an option you could see is maybe Kerstetter at right tackle and Okafor at guard. It's always a possibility. We're going to have to see how it shakes out. But, I mean, I still think overall this unit is going to be pretty good. They may have some bumps early. At least they get a game under their belt before LSU comes into town.
Yeah. I mean, like everything else, they and Ellinger will both be helped by the fast guys doing fast guy things, getting some more explosive plays, Mack Brown, TM, that don't force you to have these 10 and 11 play drives that we seem to have to rely on all the time last year. But, yeah, I mean, the tools are definitely there to be an above average, you know, for the tier that we're trying to play at, which is, you know, top of the Big 12 and trying to get with the big boys offensive line. But I just have to pause and give a shout out to Shaq, because yeah, he so embodies the type of player that, you know, for years has fucked us whenever we'd go up to Kansas State. Actually got him from Kansas State, you know, the guy that has been, you know, he was a, you know, solid, not a high 4-star, 5-star recruit, but good, solid athlete that has put in the time, has maximized, has gotten bigger, has gotten better his technique, and now he's out there as a senior and he's fucking up our more highly regarded, more highly recruited defensive linemen. And we've suffered at that guy's hands for so long, you know, in this conference, and especially heading up there to K-State. And now we've finally got him, despite starting on the track of getting thrown in the fire as a true freshman, you know, playing through injuries, looking like he just did not have it, but finally, you know, got to take time, got to heal up, got to keep working, had a very solid year last year, and now, you know, he's probably the best center in the conference coming in on paper. And yeah, you just can't overstate how important that is to, you know, just the cohesiveness of the O-line and just the fact of feeling like, hey, we're now a big boy program that has that that has that type of player, and we're finally able to stop robbing Peter to pay Paul and let the guys at the, you know, big technique and big strength positions develop to where they actually have both those things on Saturday.
Yep. It's almost impossible to overstate the importance of a senior center who you trust to make virtually any line call.
Yeah. I mean,
those guys are rare.
I mean, on the offense, it's the second most important position behind quarterback, in my opinion, on an offense, because he is a leader of that group, and they have to work as a unit so much that, yeah, I mean, that guy's got to be able to make the calls, and you need an experienced guy there who can not only handle his job but also handle that portion of it. I mean, it really is. It's to me, it's the second most important position on offense.
And if you want to save all those extra hits and wear and tear on Ellinger, yeah, how many of them get saved when you're in the right line call and mm-hmm. that free blitzer that has bedeviled the shit out of us for so many of the last years
yep.
actually gets picked up and he gets to make a nice, clean 5-step throw rather than getting hit in the teeth?
Yep.
Yeah, taking those shots off his odometer will be a big positive as well. And, yeah, that's something with a smart senior center that you hope is going to be, you know, at the table just about every game.
One of the things we mentioned earlier was, the position that is probably the most worrisome is definitely tight end. The biggest question is Cade Brewer back to being healthy and in shape like he was his freshman year? If he's not, you may not see many tight ends on the field very often. At least I hope not.
That's where I would differ with you. I think hell, high water, or any other, you know, plague of locusts, plague of frogs, you're going to see a tight end out there, whether or not it's the optimal approach. But, yeah, Brewer is your, I guess, kind of leader in the clubhouse for the most snaps. And if you had seen him as a true freshman and just projected the growth curve that everybody always wants to project on a, you know, precocious freshman. Up till now, you think this guy's gonna be a hell of a player, but last season was such a lost season that it's hard to put any stock into what he can be. His upside could still be, you know, an average Big 12 tight end, which would be a massive godsend for this program.
No joke.
But absolutely tough to put any stock in.
Well,
right,
I mean, it was such poor timing for him. I mean, that knee injury for him occurred so late in the spring, so late in the process as far as him being able to get back healthy in time. I mean, yeah, he was on the team last year and on the field, but he just wasn't himself, and you could tell. And so, you know, maybe the whole thing will hold true for him, as it does with a lot of players, of the year two, the second year after the ACL tear, that he'll be back to form and doing what everybody thought he could do. And hopefully that means some improved blocking as well, but, you know, we'll see. And out behind him, you've got a lot of nothing, really. I mean, Reese Lato, who Herman put a whole lot of, put a whole lot of goodwill into just to get him on campus, you know, needs to start paying that off. I mean, you do have a freshman talent that is an X factor in Leibrock, but, it's a worrisome position without question. And then, let's see.
Worrisome. I don't have a goddamn thing to say about it.
just so we can round out the offense, mm-hmm. You've got the known quantities of Duvernay and obviously Colin Johnson. Are any of you guys looking at the wide receiver position and looking at a guy and saying, okay, that I think that's a guy who is going to kind of jump out this
Epps,
year?
Eagles in the freshman, Smith.
Okay. Jason?
Yeah, well, I guess for me, Josh Moore, just because, number one, at least coming out of the gate, he's the one likeliest to be on the field the most. I think you've got Colin Johnson locked in at your, you know, starting X receiver. You know, Duvernay, at least coming out of the gate, is going to be, you know, split out wide as the Z on the other side and trying to finally connect on one of those posts. And, you know, Moore comes in as your most experienced, so it's not a ton of experience, you know, player at the slot, and has got, you know, at least some of that, you know, burst and wiggle and ability to get enough separation to catch the ball in space, mm-hmm. and start to do some of that explosive stuff that we've talked about. I mean, those, you know, like Eagles and Epps are both these really intriguing big frame guys. You know, Eagles, I don't know how much real, you know, athleticism and separation ability he has, and I don't know how often he's going to nudge Colin Johnson off the field unless you start getting creative and lining Johnson mm-hmm. up inside.
That's what I'd like to see just a little bit.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing that just so they could move Colin Johnson around, because I think he could eat his ability. We've seen it from him in ability to route run and use his body. He could easily duplicate, if somebody on the outside can step up and look like a consistent force, he could easily duplicate what Humphrey brought last year in that slot position.
And then some, with the even bigger frame, you know, not quite the wiggle that Humphrey had, but Humphrey didn't necessarily have a ton. But, I mean, I'm trying to find the analogy from the Cowboys.
Bill Jordan didn't have much of a wiggle. He had kind of a tremor.
Yeah.
He had restless leg syndrome, folks. Yeah. That's what he had. Yeah. But I'm blanking on the receiver, but kind of in the Dallas, the Tony Romo offense heyday, somebody that I can't believe I'm blanking on it, but like his biggest contribution was start just lining up and being a credible dude that you had to honor outside and let Dez start kicking inside and just mauling these smaller
Patrick
slot corners. Miles Austin actually did big things himself
for
a while.
True.
Just the idea, like, yeah, this is your best receiver and he could be good outside and he's built like an outside guy, but there can be so many opportunities inside, whether it's, you know, from a matchup, just from pure space, from being tougher to scheme for and cover, that, yeah, somebody that can do a credible job outside and let Johnson inside that could be the other X factor besides Whittington. So
I'll give you a guy that I'm sure most people will think I'm a little crazy, just because I'm sure people have written him off already. And maybe it's just because I would just like to see it from a personal standpoint. I would love to see the John Burt Reclamation Project, you know, and if because we've seen his big playability his freshman year. And then, you know, he got the dropsies and just had a whole mental thing with his hands. But he's persevered through all that and is still a viable member of the football team, is still out there and is still doing his thing. You know, maybe that's a guy who could kind of reclaim some of that, because we know his athleticism is off the charts. That maybe, I don't know. I would just love to see it personally. A guy like John Burt to come out and do that, because we know what he can. Yeah. We know what he can do. It's just a question of, can he get back to doing it?
Well, if he ever did it in the first place. I mean,
yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't a huge sample size of what we thought was going to be the emergence of the next grade.
Well, I mean, we just saw it. We saw it his freshman year and haven't seen it since.
Yeah. I mean, the question is how much leash he has. You know,
true.
If he makes a mistake, if he makes a drop, how much leash is he going to give himself mentally, mm-hmm. and then how much leash is the staff going to give him? It could very easily be a one and done with him.
Could be.
For mistake. But yeah, if he gets out there and starts producing, then I mean, there's no question he's at least got the athleticism to, you know, scare defenses and make some big plays. But was that the Gas Camp candidate that you were mentioning earlier?
The Gas Camp candidate I was mentioning was Kirk Johnson.
That's who I thought you were mentioning.
Yeah, that's who I thought he was thinking of too, was Kirk Johnson at tailback as a guy who could, you know, maybe emerge.
Speaking of guys that you can't put any stock into,
right.
God knows he's an athlete. The reports, you know, from some of the closed scrimmages and whatnot, like, he moves and looks like the guy that you always thought he would be. You know, he's even surpassed Jordan Shipley territory now of his first few seasons when we were calling him the White Shadow because we've never seen him.
The gray ghost.
I don't think you can use that for Kirk Johnson. I mean, the Black Shadow is just kind of a shadow. So.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you put less stock into him than an Enron relaunch. But, so many of the things we're talking about, Jordan Whittington being able to add, theoretically healthy Colin or Kirk Johnson could add a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah, he absolutely could. All right, moving over to the defensive side of the ball, which is going to be, at least early on, I think, the side of the ball that draws the most consternation, just because, you know, that Texas lost a lot from a productivity and experience standpoint.
What do you think about the defense, Craig?
Oh, shit. They lost a lot of starts. They lost a lot of experience, but did they lose a lot of good experience?
In some ways, yes.
Some ways,
in some ways, no.
Some ways, no. I mean,
and by the way, oh shit, maybe kind of the coach's mindset early on in the season on the defensive side of the ball.
I mean, catchphrase for that defense this season is going to be dirty dime. I mean, they're going to be forced into playing that because of the lack of depth at linebacker, You know, thankfully, that gets their best athletes on the field.
True. And we saw a lot of that dirty dime last year because of, you know, injuries at times and suspensions at other, and it can work for you.
I think we saw more of it the year before.
We saw a lot of it each of the last 2 years. But, you know, this year, they used it a lot the last 2 years more just because it was really effective for them. This year, they might be using it out of necessity.
Yeah, well, I mean, when the term kind of got coined, it was, you know, Malik Johnson as the starring component of that because he was a true
Who
linebacker.
Who the fuck is Malik Johnson?
Or Malik Jesus Jefferson, Christ. That guy too.
I've got a Dave Campbell show for you if you'd like to rush up.
How quickly they forget.
Oh, my God. I thought I was sitting here thinking, holy shit, there's no way in hell that anybody at this table knows less about the defense than I do.
Malik Johnson is Jason hybrid, did the hybrid Malik Jefferson-Gary Johnson combo.
Yes. We'll
it
go
was
with
the
that.
Malik Johnson combo.
We'll
that
go, yeah. You didn't hear the slash in there? The Malik / Johnson combo? but you had a nominal linebacker that ran like a safety, another linebacker in Gary Jackson, Jefferson, Johnson, Gary Johnson, that ran like a safety, even though, you know, the plug and holes bit was hit or miss. And you have to have –
multiple humans that can line up, you know, somewhere between 5 and 8 yards from the line of scrimmage and play the run with some degree of success and occasionally take on some kind of a blocker without just getting blowed the F up.
Yeah.
And the question is, who are those humans? And you may have one nominal linebacker on the field for a whole lot of the season, and the question is, how do you fill in all those other parts that have got some amazing skill sets, but how do you buck up enough in the box to let everybody's, you know, skill sets against the pass play up?
Well, we'll get into the position groups here in a second, but I think we can, all three of us can agree that if no matter how they shuffle the deck, the one thing that they have to do that they did not do well last year is get their asses off the field on third down.
Oh, without question. I mean, the third down defense was horrific last year.
I mean, they were ninth in the fucking conference last year.
Yeah, and I think that was just in Big 12 games? That might have been just in Big 12 games. But regardless, it was terrible.
Yeah.
It was.
I think they were ninth in the Big 12. You know, of the 10 Big 12 teams, they were ninth in, like, you know, third down conversions allowed, fourth down conversions allowed. And there was the mix of the frustrating, they ran for 3 yards on third and two, and then there's third and seven, and they went for 45. They just got hillaged on the money downs.
Yeah, and it was due to a number of issues. You know, as much as I like Chris Boyd's athleticism, his something shiny really caused problems for the defense at times. And hopefully, you know, you're going to have guys back there that don't have that issue.
Oh God, who was our guy? If you obviously don't trust me now to remember a former player's name, but our prior Shockey.
Oh yeah, Shockey Brown.
Shockey Jones. Shockey.
Shockey
Smith?
Brown.
Shockey Brown.
Shockey Brown.
Shaka Khan. What?
Yeah, who was basically basically Charlie Browning the defense at every third down because he would just like look. I'm thinking about pussy right now. we were playing zone. My bad. Like all the physical talent you'd want, but yeah, would just lose his mind. And
a critical element of your defensive call is getting Texas Palm to take a seat.
No, guys, the one where you throw the cheerleaders up and legs in there, don't do that on third day. Just trust us. If we check the NCAA, we can't put horse blinders on them. It's a violation. So just please just stop distracting them.
It's, you know, they're going to have to rely on a lot of inexperience in the secondary, at least to start out on the outside at the cornerback positions. But we did see flashes of those guys last year that makes you think that they're going to be very solid players, and as the season grows, hopefully, you know, very good players. But, you know, at linebacker, like you said, the dime thing, I mean, I look at the linebacker depth chart, and I'm like, I see two guys, that I might want to see on the field a decent amount, and that's it. You've got McCullough and Osai, and outside of that, if we're playing some other guys, I think some other thing, if we're playing some other guys a decent amount of snaps, something has gone wrong.
Yeah. I mean, we could go through this front to back. We could go through back to front. Seems like now we're going for the Silicon Valley middle out approach. So, yeah, I'll start with the linebackers or lack thereof. Yeah, those are two guys, both, you know, Shark McCullough and Osai, who I'd like to see on the field. I still don't know how excited I am about seeing McCullough lining up, you know, 5 yards as a typical off-the-ball spot versus, you know, more of that B-backer on the line of scrimmage position. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did look better against Georgia. He does move, you know, reasonably well in the pass game, but, you know, chasing things down laterally, you know, dealing with misdirection, things like that. I think those are major, major question marks for him, you know, holding down what I guess would be that, you know, Mac linebacker, the more traditional spot. You know, Osai, still young, but has shown a lot of things that you like. You know, that's probably of the nominal linebackers or linebacker-like ingredients that we have, he's probably the one you feel best about in that, you know, if he's playing that rover role. But then you've also got, you know, the pieces that are in those smaller, faster, is he a safety, is he a weak side, something that, you know, kind of plugging into that role might be their best fit, and you see if Osai can play more of that traditional interior linebacker spot, and then you just start playing,
you know, wild ass mix and match with the other pieces. Yeah. I mean, I guess to finish the linebacker spot, you got Delier, a day away, a whim away, Lion sleeps tonight, and you know.
Deli Adeo. I'm just gonna say Deli because Deli Adeo away.
Deli works away. He's a deli. He's a deli sandwich away from 255, and that is it's not necessarily suited to today's Big 12 or even you know 10 years ago Big 12. So we saw how much you know Anthony Wheeler, who probably had better overall movement skills, get ruthlessly exploited by Big 12 coordinators. So you know him being able to go out there without a big target on his back, I'll believe when I see.
I mean, just get used to the seeing B.J. Foster lining up as a quote-unquote safety in the defense where he's basically playing a linebacker spot because I think that's what he's going to be doing again all season.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was trying to think of in looking at the defense. You know, not so much as let's fill out, you know, the precise depth chart of this guy's in this spot, but like, what are the things that you have to do for this defense to be as successful as it can be? And that's, you know, if it's not number one on the list, it's in the top three is, yeah, B.J. Foster has to be close to the line of scrimmage, close to the box, and able to, you know, wreak havoc in all the ways he can, whether it's blitzing, whether it's chasing down the run, whether it's just, you know, breaking someone's ribs and knocking him out of the game. You know, in a lot of ways, he could physically be, you know, that – the superhuman that we seem to demand out of the nickel spot, you know, lined up in the slot, but that almost seems like you're getting him too far away from the action and too far away from a lot of the things that he can do well. So that's one of the biggest questions. Yeah, how do you keep him in the mix in the box close to the line of scrimmage, and what are you doing to line up over that dude in the slot? Because we saw a lot of guys kind of try to do that and fail last year. Some of which is because we seem to ask so much out of that position, and some because, you know, maybe we just don't have the right guy, and, you know, still don't know if we have the right guy.
Well, you know, one way they can protect that group is by having their defensive line step up and be stalwarts. Unfortunately, they lost their war daddy on the defensive line when big number 90 took his talents to the NFL after graduating last year, now down in Houston playing for the Houston Texans.
Yeah, and thank God he took his talents last year rather than 2 years ago when it was, he was looking hard at jumping early, and, you know, thank God that, you know, both for the sake of the program last year and for, you know, Tom Herman's ongoing pitches to guys to stick around, you couldn't have a better advertisement for that than how much Omenihu grew as a player, how versatile he was able to become, and the fact that it panned out for him in a quality NFL shot.
Yeah,
but yeah, his absence will be keenly felt.
And the other guy whose absence obviously would be felt is Chris Nelson, who I thought had a much more productive senior season than I was expecting him to have. I thought he would be a good solid, you know, body there in the middle to kind of take up some space, but he actually showed a pretty decent amount of penetrating ability and disruption for a guy who you hadn't seen it much from to that point. I thought he did a really good job last year making up for the loss of Puna Ford.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the trying to think about what happened to the defense from, you know, Todd Orlando's phenomenal debut to, you know, what we saw last year. You know, to me, you know, Puna Ford is far and away the biggest story because the penetration effect was was real. And
it, very much so.
You say, he was always kind of underrated and overlooked because of his size and measurables. Mm-hmm. But you suddenly realize, you know, being maybe 6 foot is really like height
Shit.
Doesn't help you that much.
Maybe
having long ass arms, so you're able to hit the offensive lineman and control him versus him controlling you.
Yep.
If you can do that, being shorter and having better leverage, hey, you're already two steps ahead of the game.
By the way, Puna intercepted a pass in a Seahawks practice today and returned it 90 yards for a touchdown.
Yeah. Puna Ford, for longer fans who haven't been following, Puna Ford has been one of the primary stories of Seahawks camp.
Oh, why?
So far,
once he got here,
yeah. Oh, yeah. He played really. He made the team last year as an undrafted free agent.
Yeah.
And had moments last year, but he's been one of the stars of camp.
I mean, not just moments. I mean, he was. You know, once he got in, he was one of the most disruptive interior defensive linemen in the NFL on a per snap basis. Not allowing for rookies, not allowing for what, like in the NFL, he was one of the best, hardest guys to block. So you kind of understand how tough he was to replace, despite the fact that he was a nominal three-star recruit.
Begging Dallas to draft him last year.
Oh, I was too.
Geez.
But you know,
so they haven't. We have Texas really hasn't had that kind of production. It's obviously missed him a lot, and I guess I'm kind of wondering. Out of the guys they have slated for the interior now, Wilbon, Coburn, you know, who knows if DeAndre Christmas ever shows up. Can any of those guys be a threat in the pass rush game?
Well, not like that.
In the middle?
In the middle.
Yeah. Thinking about this defense, like understanding what you want to call defensive line production is an interesting question.
I know that's
not
their primary role, but I mean, that was such an added bonus.
Oh yeah, no, it was massive, and not just in the pass game, but in the run game as well.
Yeah.
Like how many times he either snuffed a run out in the backfield or forced the guy to change direction and run right into Nelson or somebody else. It's huge. But when we do the alignment that Todd Orlando really favors with a nose and two guys at that four eye spot lined up right inside the tackle. Like, that's not setting anybody up for success as a pass rusher on a regular down.
And if you notice last year, they got away from that as the season went on. They got away from the yes, they still did some of the nickel, but they got into more four down line sets as the season went on just because it wasn't working early on. You know, they tried early on to go with that dirty dime look with that 3-2-6, and they were just getting lit up at times by people, and they got more consistent pressure and disruption from a four-man line once they started going with more of that look. Seemed to me, I might be wrong on that, but
yeah, no,
it sure looked that way.
I think that's true, and we're 3 days into camp, and even what we see in camp may not be an indicator of what we're going to see at the start of the season or midway through the season if we have to change. I've been going into the assumption that they'll start out again trying to find that three-down line look that will give them what they need. But, yeah, going with, four guys at least, on right around the line of scrimmage, whether you've got two down and two standing up on the flanks or three down and one up, whatever it is, that may end up being the approach that works best. But the two guys that are probably, however you line them up, going to be your best bets for disruption, I would have to think, would be Malcolm Roach and Taquan Graham.
Yeah, and I think you're gonna see Roach be that guy that kind of tries to replace the Omenihu production as much, because now that they have permanently done with the whole linebacker thing with him.
Thank God.
Yeah, thank God. And have strictly made him a defensive end.
That'll close the book on Jackson.
Thank God.
I think you're going to see Malcolm Roach take a big step forward and see more of what we saw a couple of years ago from him in spots, but you're going to see more of that on a consistent basis. Craig, you were talking about inside. I'll give you one guy I think we could see more of this year, because I think they had to do some body remaking on him, is the JC transfer who ended up redshirting last year, Jamari Chisholm. That could be a guy who gives you some disruption in the middle, because Wilbon and Keandre Coburn, they're just not those guys. Those guys are space eaters. Now, they could surprise us. I mean, I thought Chris Nelson was basically a space eater, and he showed that he could be more than that last year. But if there's one guy I'm looking at inside to cause disruption, I think it might be Chisholm.
Yeah, he's bulked up, that's for sure. I think he's listed on the depth chart generously at 305 pounds. So we'll, hopefully that extra developmental year will be meaningful. We just don't know. He's a wild card.
One guy I am kind of intrigued to see what he brings on the outside, just because we saw it in glimpses last year, was Bimage.
Yeah.
I thought there was times that he got put in, and all of a sudden you just see somebody coming around the defensive end make a play. It happened in two or three games last year. It's like, wait, who was that? That was a 40 number. Was that? Oh, wait. That was Bimage? Oh my! Look at this. We may have found something here.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, he's kind of one of the classic points, and honestly, to me, Roach as well. I think if you align them in ways that play to their strengths, they can be great players. I don't think you can use Roach the same way that you used Omenihu.
No.
You know, lining up at the, you know, at the 4-eye and get that kind of consistent production, just because he just doesn't have that same length to, mm-hmm. you know, control the tackle and then start, you know, start winning from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roach can out-quick a lot of guys, you know, can't hold up against the run. He's got the power, but if you're asking him to, like, win the arm length, hand length, control you, and then do something battle, you know, it's not really his game. And, you know, Bimage is the same way. If he's able to kind of come from an edge spot, he can cause guys problems. If he's having to, like, you know, line up and have the phone booth fight first, probably going to be tougher for him. So, yeah, both in terms of who you're putting out there and how you're aligning them is going to be really interesting to watch to see if we can, you know, tee the guys up that we have for success, because the ingredients are there, but you're going to have to do kind of a pretty interesting potpourri, which I guess is not something you eat. It's more of like a, a gumbo, a roux, I don't know. Blake Johnson, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus Christ.
You know, one guy I am kind of curious to see what he brings to the table this year. You're talking about, you know, the guys with the arm length and that can help negotiate blockers because they can hold them off. Moro Ojimo, thank you. Moro Ojimo is that kind of guy. Now, he redshirted last year. You didn't really see him much, but I saw him play his senior year in high school at Katy in a state
semifinal.
When
he was like 16, right?
Yeah, when he was 16 years old. Yeah, I mean, the kid is a year younger than everybody in his class, so he's still developing even more physically. But he was kind of – I kind of deemed it when I watched him play in Katy that he was kind of a Puna Ford starter kid. Now, he's taller. He's about 6'2", but he has those extremely, like, I wouldn't say abnormally, but he has very long arms for a guy his height, and he was doing a lot of the same things at Katy for that team that lost to Lake Travis in the state semis 2 years ago that Puna would do, because he would be in the middle of the line, and he would cause tons of disruption by just being able to hold offensive linemen off of him. And then get by and go back and get into the backfield. I'm really curious to see if he can bring some of that, because he's the kind of guy, you talk about lining up more head up as a 4-eye. He's the kind of guy who could do that if he's kind of learning how to negotiate blockers a little better, if that skill has improved.
Right. Yeah, but it's still asking a lot
True.
To do that kind of thing this year at what I think he'll still be 18.
Yeah.
There's just even if you're freakish or bordering on super freakish, you know, there's just some filling out and strength and leverage and technique stuff that just has to come, and it may not be there yet, but he'll be interesting to see what kind of flashes he can give you in the potpourri.
Definitely.
God, I hate the word potpourri.
I'm starting to hate it now too, because I keep thinking it's
every
something you eat, and it's not.
Every time somebody says potpourri, I think about that just that noxious shit my mother used to burn on the goddamn stove when I was, like, in junior high. It was such a staple of every suburban household in the early 80s. God, that shit smelled bad.
Oh, goodness. The strength of the defense, I think we can all agree, is going to be in the secondary. With returning starters Brandon Jones and Caden Stearns locking down your safety positions, and two guys in Jalen Green and Anthony Cook, who we have seen flashes of last year as having some serious ability on the outside.
Yeah, I mean, there was no question of their recruiting profiles. I mean, really, for all of those four guys that you mentioned, that they had, you know, somewhere between really solid to immense physical talent. You made good arguments for, you know, the super DB class we signed last year. You make arguments for multiple guys being the highest ceiling, the best NFL prospect, the likeliest to contribute early, and they all showed you some great stuff, you know, with BJ Foster in that mix as well. But outside corner, your two starting outside corners and your two safeties are,
pretty easy to determine in,
don't
in those
don't
guys.
Don't you mean four safeties?
Yeah, it's how many other safeties you can get on the field, and
yeah, I mean,
I think in some of their cases, how many you can convince that they're still playing safety when they may be lining up 5 yards to the ball, and you have this is your gap, and but you are a safety like we promised you.
You're playing linebacker. Sorry. Yeah, the antidote to a shitty conversation about linebackers is just talk about the safeties. I mean, they're talent rich and deep.
Yeah,
safety.
Yeah, and you may see them playing a style of ball, and the San Diego, the L.A. Chargers in front of crowds, approaching 30,000 last year. Turned in a pretty good showing at defense, playing seven DBs
at times,
for the majority. Yeah, I mean, probably the majority of their snaps, they had seven, guys who you would call DBs on the field. Like, do you get chewed up some between the 20s and the run game? Sure. Do you, on third and four, give them nowhere to throw the ball and you're off the field? Yes. Can you blitz a bunch of guys from a bunch of places and fuck up the offensive protections and be able to throw 100 mix and match, coverage options and not really give a pre-snap key as to what you're doing? Yep, you can do all that when you've got a bunch of versatile, fast dudes back there. The question is, how do you get those guys all on the same page coverage-wise without having some, last year of the Charlie Strong regime clusterfuckery back there? And, how do you hold up enough against the run to get the opportunity to tee off in tee off in third and eight?
Yeah, those guys have to play with a lot of intelligence. I mean, because I think one of the things that got Texas in trouble last season was getting a little too cute from an anticipation standpoint in their calls. And so the more that the defensive backfield can play with this is such a terrible by phrase, positional intelligence.
Yeah.
The better off they're going to be. The better working understanding of the defense they're going to have, so they can play within it instead of just being told to go to a spot.
Yeah. I mean, that most definitely. I mean, if you've got guys who are good at anticipating and reading, you don't have to make exotic calls.
Right.
You can make more basic calls where guys are just using their football IQs to be in the right spot when they need to be and making the right play, and you're not having to get tricky and leaving yourself open.
We just did.
awkward pause. But another NFL example that shows how that can work. The Indianapolis Colts last year was reading about this. They played either a very, what you'd call a base vanilla cover two or a base vanilla cover three, probably 80-90% of their snaps. They'd blitz occasionally. They'd do some other things. But they were not throwing a bunch of exotic looks at you. But a base cover two can be really good when you've got good athletes that can adapt to what they're seeing. Like, my responsibility is this. I may have to do a lot of stuff depending on whether it's a run, whether I'm seeing this route combination, whether I'm seeing that route combination. But if you've got a sound basic call and the guys understand what they're supposed to do and how what they do fits in with the guys around them and how what they're starting to see unfold from the offense means to what they should be doing and where they should be going, yeah, you don't have to have exotic calls.
Right.
You just have to have guys that can adapt and be able to, do a lot of things from a specific role or a specific job. Like, I can handle my run responsibility from this assignment. I can carry the guy vertically if I have to. I can attack the flat, but I'm doing it and I'm understanding it immediately. I'm not sitting there paralyzed going, wait, what do I – ah, fuck, he's already got the ball.
Texas had that 2 years ago, the first year under Orlando. As you talked about, a lot of athleticism, but you had guys on the field. Guys were doing a very good job of not only knowing their responsibility, but how what they're supposed to do fit into everything else. And so Texas was able to play a pretty simple, yes, it was that, dirty dime that we like to call it, but they were able to play that the majority of the time because everybody was doing their job so well. And handling their responsibility and seeing things unfold and were able to attack from those positions without opening themselves up to other things.
Yeah. So, I mean, net for the defense, if they don't take a good step forward from last year despite losing, a good amount of at least nominal starts and experience, then this team is going to have some problems, even if the offense does take a step forward. But you don't have to be, you know, a top 10 kick-ass stem-to-stern defense for this to be a really successful team and a really successful defense. But, you know, you just have to get back to what we started on. Get the hell off the field on third down. Don't have those breakdowns. And, you know, have guys be able to line up and play football and not be either, you know, locked into a predetermined call that can get beat by another call, or just generally not understand what the hell they're supposed to be doing. And you're plugging in so many new parts that that risk seems really high that you're going to have some of those things happen.
Especially early.
But it's, yeah, exactly. But this has got the potential to be a defense that, that frustrates early and plays really well down the stretch if, you know, if some of these potpourri pieces start to blend together in a fragrant way. That
Could you please stop using that?
I'm just doing it to fuck
word.
You now, obviously.
God almighty.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think Texas fans should expect the defense to have struggles early on.
And they can't afford to.
Well, yeah, I mean, now they've got two of their first three games are Louisiana Tech and Rice, but yeah, you do have the home game against LSU. Now, LSU is not that LSU has a lot of talent, but LSU has still yet to be able to put that talent into anything resembling a dynamic offense.
I guess we're just talking about the schedule now.
No, I'm just saying that because
no,
of
we can
that,
go and talk about the schedule. Nobody gives a shit about special teams anyway.
Cameron Dicker.
Dicker the kicker. We'll have them.
Dicker the kicker. Hopefully the Australian, you know, follows the path of his cousin.
First person to spell Bushahovsky correctly or pronounce it correctly, which I'm sure I didn't, wins a prize.
Yeah.
But that's special teams, folks.
Yeah,
have fun.
If we have a kick return over 30 yards, it'll be the first time in forever, so I'll be happy about that. But I haven't seen it yet. Won't believe it till I see it. Anything else on special teams? No. Probably not.
So, schedule.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the schedule sets up at least to, you know, before conference play gets going. They've got Louisiana Tech at home, and then they play Rice down in Houston, and then you've got the big LSU game. You know, LSU, if, you know, they're returning the majority of their starters. I think they're returning 17 of their 22 starters, I think, if I read that right. So they're going to have a lot of talent on both sides of the ball returning to, from a 10-3 squad last year and should have been 11-2 and probably in a better bowl game. They got dicked in College Station pretty hard by the officiating crew. But
yeah, so last thing got dicked that hard in College Station said bah.
Or it barked.
But, you know, LSU has never been a dynamic offense. Now, they can beat you down with their, you know, with their run game and with their power up front, but they've never been an uber-explosive offense through the air, and I don't expect that to change this year. So, you know, your first probably real huge challenge from a defensive standpoint will probably be Oklahoma State here in Austin.
See, I don't know.
In September, because OSU is OSU.
I don't know. I think the thing about LSU is that we just don't know. They got that, you know, I can't remember the son of a bitch's name, the passing game coordinator from the Saints, you know, because him Singer needs some help. if that's who's still there. But and they've got so much talent at the skill positions. And Burrow is very competent. And I think if they made some improvements scheme-wise offensively, they're going to be harder to handle than their track record suggests. So I'm just not, you know, I'm not willing to just sit here and say right now that we can match up with LSU because they don't play the kind of the brand of offense has traditionally given us more problems.
Well, I agree that they're going to be very difficult to play, and you're right about Burrows. He's a very solid quarterback. The question for LSU is their offensive line going to have improved from last year? Because their offensive line had issues last year, especially at protection. That was their kind of their biggest failing. They could run the ball decently well, but their pass protection was terrible last year. So if that's improved, then yeah, Texas could be in for a – I mean, they're going to be in for a fight regardless, but they could be in a really world of hurt if their offensive line has stepped up their protection.
Yeah, I think that it's hard to look at, you know, this LSU team and think that, you know, this offense rolling in is going to be scarier than Georgia's offense was the end of year last year.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And Todd Orlando went and shut that down. And, you know, I was thinking as he came in and was always referring to him as, you know, the spread destroying, you know, super dime wizard, whatnot. And he's, you know, had his problems against the Big 12, as basically everyone has, because it's a hell of an offensive conference. But when he's faced one of those more traditional, you know, pro style, for lack of a better word, offense, produced really well, you know, despite relying on some of these, you know, just smaller, faster players, when you assume that it's just going to be some, you know, big man on big man slugfest. But, you know, just as, you know, seems to the speed revolution always hits, you know, defenses every decade or so. And, you know, Jimmy Johnson brought it to the Cowboys in the 90s. And, you know, you're kind of seeing it now that you can actually outnumber, outrun, and, you know, beat the hell out of a nominally bigger, stronger, tougher pro-style offense when you've got, you know, the athletes and the sophistication on D. So, yeah, that game to me, I think it's the first 24 wins, and, you know, could well be lower than that.
Yeah, I mean,
I will eagerly bet the under if it presents. And I haven't even looked at it yet, but if it's anything south of 50 or anything north of 50, I'm going to be all over that.
Yeah, I mean, barring turnovers, I just, you know, I don't see either team scoring in the 30s. You know, it because both teams, LSU's going to be good, very good defensively. They were last year, but yeah, it's going to be a dogfight in that game.
Well, the thing about Burrow, both him and Ellinger just don't really turn the ball over. I think
right.
both of them only had 5 picks last year. There were more picks in a Jackson 5 dressing room than either of those guys had. So I think they'll both play pretty clean on offense. So we'll just. Yeah, you know, we'll see. For some reason, that game scares me more than it does y'all. I don't know why.
I'm not sitting here predicting Texas to just outright win it. I guess I look at it as like, yes, Texas. I think Texas matches up well with them on paper, just because of, you know. I mean, I'm going by what I saw from LSU last year. They were obviously a good football team. They were as good as Texas last year, maybe a little bit better. But, you know, I think they win most of their games with that typical SEC, you know, we're going to kind of beat you into submission type of game plan. And Jason has brought it up well, at least from a defensive standpoint. Todd Orlando has done very well against those types of teams. I mean, I was as shocked as anybody as at how Texas was able to control Georgia's offense in the Sugar Bowl last year. I mean, it was astounding. I just didn't see that coming at all.
One thing is for sure, that week gives us license to listen to as much Ed Orgeron as we can possibly cram into a single day.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, it's one of the great guilty pleasures of being a college football fan. We got the shoe bubble. Wada,
football.
I mean, Farmer, he is Farmer Fran in real life. He absolutely is Farmer Fran in real life, and it's not even close.
Yeah, it would not surprise me if he has a nipple ring.
Oh, goodness. As far as the Big 12 goes, when I look at the schedule, they get Oklahoma State here, which I think translates into a Texas win just because
Well, now that Walt Anderson's out of the conference.
Now that Walt Anderson's out, yeah, no joke. I think OSU is still going to have some tricks up their sleeve because Gundy always does, but they've got a new quarterback again. Texas gets them early in the season. I'll believe OSU is good on defense when I see it, not before. And I think this crew is going to want to kind of get a little revenge for that loss that kind of knocked them off their platform last season up in Stillwater. West Virginia, I think, is going to take a big step back this year because they lost a ton of talent and their head coach. Oklahoma's going to be the favorite in the conference coming in, as well they should be. But I don't think Oklahoma's going to be as explosive offensively. I personally don't see Oklahoma being as explosive offensively as other people do. I don't think this plug-and-play thing just works automatically every time. And a lot of people seem to be expecting Jalen Hurts just to be plug-and-play and just do what Baker Mayfield and Kyler Murray did the last 3 years, and or 4 years, really. And I just don't see that because I don't think he's that skilled of a quarterback.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, as they said about great Redskins cornerback Darryl Green, once he was about, 35, 36 years old. So when he said, well, he's lost a step, and the response was, yeah, he had a step to lose.
That's very true.
the Sooners offense could take a pretty decent step back and still be a top five offense in the nation because, yeah, I mean, they're that loaded on the lines, the skill guys with guys like CeeDee Lamb.
That's the other thing, though, is their offensive line, what's it going to be like this year? Because they lost a lot of experience and talent to the league off that line from last year.
Yeah, when that line ever takes a halfway significant step back, I'll believe it. But Trey, you had a question about Lincoln Riley, didn't you, for the panel?
Yes. I'm wondering if anybody here would piss on Lincoln Riley if they found him on fire. Personally, I would not.
Yes, I guess. If nothing else, just so I could say I pissed on him.
Yeah, I think I definitely would. I would just make sure not to piss on the part of him that was on fire. There we go. That's been your Whip
We're
Around
mean.
Roundtable of the Week, folks.
God, I hate that bastard.
Oh, God. As far as the rest of the Big 12 goes... the rest of the Big 12's got a whole lot of unknowns, honestly. It's, Kansas sucks. They'll always suck. I don't care if Les Miles is there.
But they'll be entertaining.
Yeah, Les Miles will make them more quotable and more entertaining, but they are not going to be very good. TCU, I do expect them to bounce back a little bit just because I don't think Gary Patterson's going to have back-to-back years like that, but their quarterback position is in some deep shit right now, and that could keep them from bouncing back maybe as Gary Patterson would hope. Iowa State might be the third best team in the conference.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, it would not be shocking.
I mean, they surprised everybody last year with the season that they had, and their quarterback is now going to be a sophomore. Matt Campbell has shown himself to be very good at taking the talent he has and putting a good product on the field with it. And using what he has well, especially on the defensive side of the ball, they seriously might be the third best team, and Texas gets them up there in November, which could be a little frightening.
Yeah, depending. I mean, if you buy OU as the favorite in the conference, I mean, they were the favorite last year. They were the better team last year.
Yeah.
We still beat them in the Red River Shootout,
yep.
So won't take anything for granted, a win or a loss there. But if that doesn't go your way, then, yeah, the Iowa State game could be tremendously important as to whether you get to go back and have that, a second Big 12 title rematch with OU, or whether you're sitting at home watching the Cyclones tee off against them. Because, we've mentioned some of the holes in the other teams in the conference. It wouldn't be insane that, if Iowa State does beat Texas and they go on a run, Texas gets in a hole there, has a good season all the way around, but can't catch up with those two losses to, make it into the Big 12's idiotic, but hey, we have it title game.
I mean, when you look at the rest of the league, I mean, Baylor took a step forward last year with Brewer at quarterback and under head coach Matt Rhule, but they're still an extremely thin team on both sides of the ball, and you really kind of look at them last year. They seemed like their wins was a lot of smoke and mirrors last year. I don't know if that team is really ready to make a step forward yet. Kansas State, absolute X factor, because Snyder is finally gone, as Kansas State finally made a coaching change, and they brought in the guy from North Dakota State that won six freaking national championships at 1AA. And it's you just don't know how what he does is going to translate, or if it will translate, at least in season one under him, because that Kansas State team just didn't have a ton of talent last year.
Yeah, and they're never a team that is going to recruit lights out,
no.
Or even, you know, with half the lights out, or, you know, even, you know, whatever candle power analogy is not really coming to me immediately. Yeah, I certainly would not discount anybody's abilities as a coach, because they were coaching at a,
yeah,
you know, lower rank of college football. A good coach is a good coach, and, you know, just as, you know, a good coach should always try to take the opportunity to land at a program where they can be successful in the next run up rather than being totally structurally disadvantaged. You know, a program can find, you know, a great coach at a lower level than rather than finding a pretty good one, but yeah, he was at a high level, but he's pretty good. But I'm just going to lean back on the entire history of the Kansas State program
outside
with
of
and
Bill
without
Snyder.
Bill Snyder,
yeah.
And say, yeah, if you have found another truly generational talent that could, you know, elevate that team, especially right off the bat, then good job. I would say the odds speak pretty strongly against
yeah,
that.
And I made him say it was four national championships in five seasons for Chris Klieman at North Dakota State. So not six, but still, that's a lot of national championships. It's just going to be a question of, can he, like you said, repeat some of the magic that Bill Snyder could do as far as, you know, using the talent he brought in, bringing in kids to fit his system, because you know he's not going to get top-end talent to that part of the country. And then, of course, Texas Tech is also under a first-year head coach. They're going to have Alan Bowman, their starting quarterback, healthy, which is a big plus for them. But it's first year post-Kingsbury, who somehow is, as you said, off the air, seems to fail upward. Cliff Kingsbury does. But
God, what an unbelievable story.
Yeah, it's incredible. But it's, you know, it's a first-year head coach. He's coming from Utah State, I believe. Matt Wells, the head coach at Texas Tech, so it's a little bit different system. They're not running the bro spread that Kingsbury had. So it'll be interesting just to see how they play. But again, it's just an unknown quantity that you just look at and you go, I mean, how can you possibly know what to expect from a group that was a 500 team and is going under a complete change?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so that's going to be all for this episode of Barking Carnival Unplugged.
Yes, the Barking Thunder podcast from Mount Carmel.
Yes. The Mount Carnival podcast, yes. Yeah. Live here from Mount Thunder, and we're going to hopefully be back on a regular rotation here as the season goes on for you guys, because we want to do it as well. Not that we didn't want to do it last year, but life sometimes interferes with such things. But that's kind of where our thoughts are as camp has gotten rolling here in Austin. So we should be back to your ears next week with another episode, as we'll have some more updates from Texas Longhorn Camp, as well as maybe a little look around what else is going on in college football. As things go on, we will work in the Ugly Johnny Dickshot baseball minute as we get closer to the postseason. Craig, any particular thoughts at this moment about the baseball race?
Go Dodgers.
Go Dodgers. There you go.
And I'm reading up on this promising freshman, Colt McCoy, so I'll have a lot more to contribute next week.
Yes, you're getting closer, Mr. Connery. You are. You're at least into this century now, which is a positive. But I think a little bit more research there, and you'll be caught up to us.
It's more than I can say for your shirt choice.
Well, yes. Okay. Well, wardrobe is, you know, always questionable on my end. I can't deny that. That's going to do it for us here for Barking Carnival Unplugged. For Jason Chilton, a.k.a. Nobis60, for Craig Douglas, a.k.a. W.W. McLeod, and for myself, Jacob Dedamore, I am on Twitter as Kip's Big Boy. Until you hear from us again, everybody have a great week, and hook 'em.